all-time great laughs. And, you know, it was very sad when his voice went away. But at the same time, I mean, that I just felt like that made him into something else in a way. You know, when he went through cancer, when he lost his voice, I just felt he was almost reborn into somebody who was all the more inspiring. I mean, this is an industry that just keeps contracting. People just keep losing their jobs. It's not, you know, those have jobs, they don't pay very well. And yet he was still there. He just kept staying in the picture. You know, he kept writing at an unbelievable pace. It's a real inspiration to all of us of what it was and it is.
What's interesting is that if we look back on Ebert's career, especially as like a TV critic, he opened the doors for a lot of people. It really feels like he did something that was really important in his era, which was we didn't have the internet to disseminate all this information to people. And at the time, it was important to have somebody who was up there, who was very public, saying, hey, guys, there are all these smaller movies. Hopefully they'll open near you soon. It's important that you see these when they come out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the fact is, not all of us live in New York City. You know, we don't have access to these things. Speaking for myself, you know, I grew up, you know, in suburban Toledo and suburban Atlanta. I would not have been aware of so many films that they were championing on that show. You know, people called him often and rightly the most powerful critic there was, but he used those powers for good. You know, he often used those powers to champion films that needed the help. As a young person growing up, you know, in the 80s, I mean, every Christmas I'd get a copy of his movie Home Companion guide, which had all of his reviews in it. And this is, again, pre-internet. I didn't have access to any of these reviews until I got that book, and it was just incredible. I mean, you get the book and you try to seek out everything he gave 4 stars to, and you'd have little arguments in your head with him. You know, I mean, you'd really start that conversation, and you know, that's a huge impact. I mean, that's affecting, you know, millions of people.
It seemed like he was pretty future-looking, too. I mean, he really respected the tradition of film criticism, but he was always trying to come up with new ways to do it, you know, by the web or through TV when he was trying to relaunch his show.
Yeah, you know, I think he certainly saw it as a global concern. He had and has his far-flung correspondence, which is a collection of bloggers from around the world who contribute to his site. You know, and he just took very passionately to the web, to blogging, to Twitter, to sort of finding and championing, you know, young voices that were completely untested often. I mean, you know, that didn't even really have a publication. I think he welcomed, you know, as many voices, you know, into that conversation as possible. And I think that was pretty forward thinking on his part.
That's Scott Tobias. He's the film editor at the AV Club. And one of the young voices that Tobias was referring to has to be Ignaty Vishnevetsky. When Ebert relaunched his TV show At the Movies in 2011, he promoted Vishnevetsky from a specialty blogger about movies to an actual TV star. Well, the show has gone away, but Vishnevetsky continues to blog for RogerEbert.com, and he said that the news was surprising even to the people who were working with him yesterday.
I think it was a big shock to everyone. I mean, you know, there were discussions about the site up until, you know, about that point. I mean, I submitted a review earlier this morning, so everything was still kind of going forward and, you know, working at the same pace it had been.
It's interesting watching that show, like the latest incarnation of At the Movies that the two of them put together. It really seemed like Roger was as interested in kind of the future of film criticism as he was in its tradition. Like, he really, you know, tried to bring in all these new voices. He was willing to experiment with formats. I mean, what did you think about
that? Well, I think he loved finding new voices. I think he loved supporting people. He was an incredibly generous person, which I think pretty much everyone has said at this point, but it's completely true. He was an incredibly generous person and very supportive. That didn't mean that he was, you know, say, easy on you. You know, he would push you.
What do you think it was about Roger that gave him that quality that people were just really drawn to him?
Checking my Twitter the way all critics do, and somebody had tweeted, you know, we will never agree on anyone the way we agreed on Ebert, which is a play on kind of a famous line from Lester Bangs about Elvis Presley, but I think it's completely true. For many people, he was the kind of public intellectual, you know, that was approachable for them, because he was utterly unpretentious, and at the same time, he was a very smart, very brilliant guy. he never really pushed his intelligence on people. I think that's what really appealed about him. He had this kind of very, you know, old school kind of newspaper style. His prose and his writing was always very crisp and direct, especially in the last few years. It had this pureness to it. It was very simple, where he was able to articulate very expressively very complicated ideas, but in very simple language. He seemed very approachable, you know. He wrote the way he talked.
One thing I find really interesting about his writing is that I feel like he's one of the few critics who could write about something that he loved and it would be a really great piece of writing. Because, I mean, I feel like it's easy to write about something you really hate. It's easy to write about something with problems, but it's hard to, like, write about something you're really passionate about.
But at the same time, I feel like that's what's at the root of all good criticism. I think, ultimately, you know, it's got to be about your love for something. It's got to be about your passion for something. Love is difficult to express. I think we know that, you know, pretty much everybody knows that. And it's even harder when you're having to express it to a very large group of people. It's hard enough to express it to one person. but when you have to express it to an audience of millions. And I think he was very good at it. He was very good at conveying his passions.
I mean, that said, he also wrote the best takedowns.
It's true, but I think ultimately he wrote great takedowns because of the love for the medium. I think when you love something enough, when someone does it poorly, it hurts you personally. I feel like it's not empty snark, though he could be really snarky and funny, certainly.
I really feel like Ebert was just this inspiration during his illness. Like, even though he was sick, he kept showing up every day. It was really inspiring to watch.
Yeah, but I think people don't maybe aren't aware, because he was, you know, in some ways he was very open about it. In other ways, I think he sort of downplayed, I think, how difficult just ordinary things were for him. You know, because the illness had not just kind of robbed him of, you know, his voice, it had robbed him of a lot of mobility and a lot of energy. I mean, fairly basic things were really difficult for him. I mean, you know, this is a guy who had trouble, you know, going up a flight of stairs or sitting down into a chair unassisted. And yet he was able to, his energy just, it all went into his intellect, you know. Though he could be very expressive physically, you know, he was kind of like he had this great pantomime ability, this kind of silent comedian quality, because he'd lost his voice. He was very expressive with his hands, and he would kind of mime things, and obviously, you know, he would communicate with these little intertidal notes that he would pass around, you know, from his notepad. He just put it all into, you know, put his time into writing. I mean, he wrote so much. It's really intimidating when you think about it. I mean, when he announced the semi-hiatus recently, you know, I think pretty much every article pointed out the fact that in 2012 he had published 306 reviews, which is, you know, a little less than six a week, which is about how many, you know, a lot of publications run.
That's just incredible to think he could write, you know, almost every single day. I mean, but he was so well-read. Like, how did he find the time to make all of that work?
You know, I really have absolutely no idea. And I worked with the guy.
That's Ignaty Vishkovetsky. He's a blogger for RogerEbert.com. To hear all of our tributes and old interviews with Roger Ebert, visit our website, will.illinois.edu. And I'll see you at the movies. You're listening to WILL.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Docha, presenting the 2013 Docha Festival, featuring chamber music events and young people's concerts April 5th through April 7th at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Champaign. A complete list of festival performances is at docha.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 5th of April, 2013. It's the birthday of Thomas Hobbes, Westport, Wiltshire, England, 1588, who witnessed a chaotic time in English politics, two civil wars, the execution of the king. He wrote his most famous book, Leviathan, in the midst of it, in which he argues that people need a strong central authority to keep them from collapsing into war and chaos. a world with no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. He believed that because we don't share the same ideas about what's right and wrong, we need a sovereign to enforce a set of laws. It's the birthday of the poet Algernon Charles Swinburne, London, 1837, born to the aristocracy, so he never had to work for a living, which gave him the freedom to be outrageous. He had wild red hair. He drank to excess. He screamed his poetry aloud while he was skipping around the room, and he wandered around Oxford at night screaming blasphemies, wrote poems about sex and sadomasochism and vampires, which shocked the Victorians and which nobody has read ever since. It's the birthday of the father of antiseptic medicine, Joseph Lister, born in Upton, England, 1827. He was a surgeon at the Glasgow Royal Infirmary, where about half of all patients in surgery died later of what was called ward fever. The prevailing theory of infection was that it was caused by miasma, or bad air. But Lister thought that infection might be caused by an invisible dust like pollen, so he experimented with using carbolic acid to clean wounds, and he required his surgeons to wash their hands before and after surgery, which was completely new at the time, and the mortality rate in his ward dropped to 15%, and a couple years later, down to 5%. And it's the birthday of Robert Bloch, born Chicago, 1917, the novelist who created the psychopathic killer Norman Bates in his novel Psycho, which Alfred Hitchcock made into a famous movie. Robert Bloch, who liked to use comedy in his stories, he said, "Comedy and horror are opposite sides of the same coin. I have the heart of a child. I keep it in a jar on my shelf." Here's a poem for today by Louise Glick, Primavera. Spring comes quickly. Overnight, the plum tree blossoms. The warm air fills with bird calls. In the plowed dirt, someone has drawn a picture of the sun with rays coming out all around. But because the background is dirt, the sun is black. There is no signature. Alas, very soon, everything will disappear. The bird calls, the delicate blossoms. In the end, even the earth itself will follow the artist's name into oblivion. Nevertheless,